All right, we're going to get started here. Welcome. This is the I don't know what you would call this panel. Brace yourself panel. Spiked when media managers can't handle the truth. We may laugh occasionally, but it's not because what we're talking about is funny. But it may be the only uplifting part of the hour here. So I'm being frank. So we have an astonishing panel here. If you go to your program, you'll see the bios here. But very obviously, we have, to my immediate right, we have Walt Bogdanich, the three-time Pulitzer Prize winner from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, ABC News, 60 Minutes, and anyone else I missed? No, I was a Cleveland Plain Dealer. Anyway, and if you read the bio, it's pretty awesome. Next is Frank Kuhn, who's won two Emmys, came here from Mexico today just to talk to you. And he's a brilliant producer, and if you read his bio, he too has produced for a number of outlets. And of course, we have Marty Kuhn. They are related, yes, uncle and nephew. That would be the uncle. Yeah. And Marty has won four Emmys, 11 or 13 nominations. I forget what the numbers are. But anyway, we all have known each other. This is not a panel of the four amigos, although we have all known each other for years, and we are veterans of network television news and other things. My name is Charles Lewis. I work at American University. I run an investigative reporting workshop, which is a long story. Anyway, but check it out. Before we get into the weeds here about particular stories, I should say, and I apologize for this, but I'm just telling you, what you're hearing is in this book. There is a chapter about corporate stories in particular that, and one industry in particular, tobacco, where 60 years of spiked stories, multiple journalists, 1940 to 2000, and there's a lot of very detailed new information, including about what you're going to hear up here. So if this fascinates you, probably everyone in this room who's ever done any investigative reporting has had these things happen. I would just mention, in case you're wondering, we also, as you know, this is prevalent. And so Amanda Bennett, we tried to get her for this panel. As you probably are aware, the Bloomberg investigative unit basically shut down when management didn't want to report about China because it might upset their investors/clients recently, as in a few months ago. One of the people I did not get a chance to write about in the book, but I will write in the IRE Journal in an upcoming issue relating to this whole subject. Sherry Jones had a documentary called Torturing Democracy. She had eight former U.S. officials, including the Undersecretary of State, all talking about torture, using that word, in the Bush administration and the war on terror. PBS was afraid to broadcast this. And it spilled into a little bit of the news in the 11th hour, but the whole story's not been told, and she has email traffic telling her the only air date will be sometime, January 20th, 2009, maybe. In other words, and that email was in 07. So think about that a minute. Anyway, this is quite a common phenomenon. Now, Sherry could not be here either, so we had all kinds of ideas here that this is very, pretty much on the same subject. One of the things in the book that I want to mention is there's an instance involving Morton Mintz, longtime veteran investigative reporter, and years ago, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, it's part of the Center for Public Integrity that Bill Buesenberg leads, had a group meeting with some of the leading journalists. So Bob Woodward spoke to the group, and he admitted, and it's in the book, and it's never been reported, that he had blocked Morton Mintz's reporting on tobacco because he felt it was a legal product. And Morton I told him about it later, and he is quoted in the book. He's one of the icons in our profession, in my opinion, one of the greats. So even Bob Woodward found himself reluctant to cover the subject of tobacco, and that was in the 80s. In 1988, I did a story with Rich Bonin, co-produced, and Mike Wallace was the correspondent at 60 Minutes. I used to work there. And the owner of CBS also owned a tobacco company. I hate when that happens. Lawrence Tisch. And there was a scene where he asked Mike Wallace not to broadcast the story. And Mike, we were not in the room, Rich and I, but he said that he told Tisch to go to hell. And then after we aired during the piece, in it, we said, Lawrence Tisch, president of CBS and also president of Lorillard, declined to comment. And he did decline to comment on the air. So then a few months later, there was a 20th anniversary of 60 Minutes at the Tavern on the Green in New York, a very fancy affair, all these corporate suit types. And then the producers, Mike Wallace saw Tisch a few feet away, and the piece had aired, and he says, he has that twinkle in his eye, and I know I'm in big trouble. There's going to be a problem here. He loved to embarrass people, and it was like his favorite thing, see his career. But anyway, he looked at me, and he looked at Tisch, who was like 10 feet away or 15 feet, and he said, hey, Larry, come here. There's somebody I want you to meet. And I'm like, oh, my God, to myself. So Tisch walks over, and we shake hands. And he goes, this is Charles Lewis. He's the producer who stuck that tobacco story right up your ass. And I said, hello. What do you say? So Tisch and I are both red. And, of course, Mike is beaming. Mission accomplished. So the reason that's relevant is that's a time when it worked, partly because Don Hewitt and Mike Wallace were mad at CBS. The Tisch had fired 450 people, and they had wanted certain things. They thought he was another Paley. It turned out he wasn't. I think that's putting it charitably. And, Paley himself was in the cigar industry. The whole reason he was able to afford CBS, that's a long conversation. Okay, so... I won't give away what you're about to hear. For those of you that might not know, this is basically roughly 20 years ago what we're describing. It happens to be in the 20th century, I think, and I've actually studied this a bit over the last 9 years. It's actually, I think it is, the worst moment, a perfect storm for media censorship in the United States, certainly for television, but I would say publicly one of the worst ever in the history of our profession. So what you're about to hear is grim, and we have not a lot of time, but I wanted to set the table here, and sequentially, the way we're going in this order is the first story that you'll hear about, which is not unrelated at all to what you're going to hear. These two are both at the same network, go back to 1994, '93 and '94, just to set the stage, in 94, after a lot of this occurs, in the midst of it, you have the seven CEOs of the tobacco industry all swearing under oath that they will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in front of Congress, and all of them say they're not aware there's a health problem with tobacco, and they don't, as far as they can tell, they don't know if it causes cancer. This is 40 years after the Surgeon General report said it kills you, basically. So what you're about to hear is what occurred next with these valiant soldiers here in the war for truth. So anyway, Walt, you're up. And you can either
Yeah, okay, sure.
I guess it'll come off. We got it.
I'm here for basically one reason, because I got sued for $10 billion by Philip Morris. Other than that, really, I have not much to contribute. It might be a problem for some of you in this room to be sued for $10 billion. It turned out it wasn't for me because I had an $11 billion trust fund, which left an extra billion for a little walking around money, so drinks on me tonight, folks. Let's start with the obvious. This was not a serious lawsuit. I mean, you don't sue me, you know, working class kid from Gary, Indiana, for $10 billion because you're serious. I mean, about collecting the money. I mean, the whole idea was shock and awe and to scare other people away from doing their jobs and to scare us away from continuing to do our reporting. And you know, it was pretty obvious why, because the lawsuit was filed just before the congressional hearings. And as Chuck mentioned, you know, those seven guys, CEOs, standing up saying nicotine's not addictive and really they're not so sure that smoking's a bad thing. And, you know, in the next year, they quietly left. Every one of them was out. And they were out because I think they were pursuing other career opportunities. I think they were I think they wanted them out so they wouldn't be, like, indicted for perjury, you know, because clearly they weren't telling the truth. Shock and awe, yeah, it, of course we did continue to report. And because of, I think in part because of the lawsuit and because of part of the work we did, we got, you know, handed the best documents in history, which proved the lies of the tobacco industry for decades and decades. Never more important cache of documents than these. And I got a call and was told to go to some hotel in Kansas and be there at 8 o'clock the next morning, and pick up, you know, one of these deals, knock on a door and ask for Joe or something. And all of a sudden, I'm handed documents, and on the plane home, I'm reading them and kind of covering my thing. Oh my God, these things are incredible, and I'm so excited, and this is a huge story, and we've been sued for $10 billion. This is going to be a wonderful vindication and all this stuff. And I get back, and I'm met by one of our lawyers at ABC. He says, got some documents, huh? I go, yeah, good stuff. He said, you mind if I get a copy of them? And these were sort of the creme de la creme of these documents and a stack about like this. So I said, sure, yeah, they're really good stuff. And so the next day he calls me and he says, you know, I didn't see anything in those documents. And I said, well, yeah, that's why you're the lawyer and I'm the journalist. Yeah. And so we continued to work. And by the way, the guy teaches at Columbia University, J School. You know, figure that one out. So I am in Washington continuing to work, and I get an urgent call from my associate producer who says, they're confiscating all our documents, our hard drive, any copies, you know, any notes, and they're going to come after you. And when you come back, and be prepared. And I'm thinking, I felt like I was in, you know, Chile during the Pinochet years. I mean, they're like, this is not supposed to happen. And so they confiscated the documents with the, and I'll be ending here shortly. Because they figured it was legally, we had no reason to have it. And if we reported what was in those documents, ABC would be, they'd put bars, you know, they'd put 2x4s across the door and put us out of business. It was ridiculous, of course, and the news division was outraged, and we had a big meeting in Rune Arledge's. Well, it wasn't actually in his office. It was where all the corporate executives meet, big mahogany table, and everybody's sitting around their rooms there. Other people are there. And the general counsel and lawyers were there, one of whom now, you know, I think is general counsel of Disney, Walt Disney. And they were explaining that, no, we can't use these documents because, you know. And I said, really? I think we can. They said, well, we've checked with 2 Washington law firms. And those 2 Washington law firms have told us that you're going to be in big trouble if you use those documents. So it's a big table, all these journalists around here, and I'm thinking, okay, who's going to ask the question? Nobody, so I will. I said, okay, what were the names of those 2 law firms? Oh, well, we can't really disclose that. You're not, well, that's a really valuable opinion then that they gave. They're doing that in secret. I knew pretty much then we were cooked. and long story short, and I'll pass this on to the next speakers. I mean, I could talk about this for a million years. It felt like a million years. I can tell you that much. But, you know, I was kept being promised that I was going to, my day would come. We would present our, you know, motion for summary judgment where all the documents that we had gotten through discovery would be released. And Walt, you're right. They're going to be vindicated. Yes, there have been all these leaks from the tobacco industry. They had a former investigative reporter from the Washington Post who went to work for Philip Morris, and he had a pipeline into the Washington Post. And, and I was told my day will come. So I waited for my day, and my day didn't come because the document that they said they were going to file publicly, they filed under seal. And I asked the lawyers why, and they said, well, ABC told us to file it under seal. And if I didn't know my goose was cooked then, it's certainly what it did now. And then I think about a week later or several days later, I kind of learned why. Because the company then was sold to Disney. And a lot of people made a lot of money in stock options and all kinds of things. And people walked off wealthy and happy. And I was sort of left with to pick up the pieces. And some of the pieces are over here. And so with that segue.
Can I interject one? Just to clarify for those playing at home, the name of the segment, the part of the day one show that you're talking about was Smokescreen, aired February 28, 1994, almost a month later. On March 24th, 1994, Philip Morris announces that they're bringing the $10 billion lawsuit. And you'll hear what happened hours after that press conference. Hours, literally hours, another documentary suddenly that had been approved had some problems, et cetera. So you had the stage is set. And Frank, maybe you could start in about, because of what you were doing, the substance of what you were doing had never been done, journalists, just as yours had never been done. No one had ever shown that levels of nicotine and all that were in any way affected or altered by the industry and deep cough and all the things that are in your story. There was a remarkable story. It was a seminal story in the history of tobacco. And then everyone is excited. Oh, my gosh. And then you guys are looking at the in terms of carnage and death in the world, the biggest, even bigger story outside the U.S. And I'll let you guys go further. But I wanted to set the stage because the story that you were doing was a pretty astonishing attempt to tell a story that's still not been fully told in this country, in my opinion. Anyway, here you go.
Well, all right, I guess it falls to me to say nice things about ABC News here since nobody else will. So starting in 1993, ABC News was starting a new weekly hour-long documentary series called, it eventually became Turning Point, but it was called Moment of Crisis back then. And the idea, the series had a concept, which was to look at a moment of crisis of some sort and expand out on it. And this was in early 1993 when we started working on this, and the idea was that the tobacco industry was sort of facing a unique moment of crisis in its history. You had a number of lawsuits sort of not going their way, the FTC starting to come after their advertising. You had that secondhand smoke report from the EPA. And so, you know, and the numbers of smokers in the U.S. was steadily dropping. So they were actually, you know, it seems remarkable now, but 20 years ago, there was this appearance that they were sort of on the ropes. And so we wanted to sort of examine that moment. We pitched this to ABC, and they were enthusiastically behind this. And this was going to be one of the first hours of Turning Point, which was not yet on the air yet. It wouldn't come on the air for another year. And so we broke the story, and the story covered a lot, but basically the three major areas that we were looking at were sort of their creative ways of getting around advertising and marketing bans through sort of non-traditional advertising, stuff that, again, 20 years on, it's all very well known. But at the time, these were sort of unconventional, you know, sort of using front groups and, you know, smokers' rights groups and, you know, using tobacco farmers as lobbyists and all of that to sort of get around the various sort of restrictions on what they saw as their First Amendment right to advertise their product. We also looked at the way that they were outsourcing their tobacco farming around the world. One of the most effective lobbying tools that the tobacco industry had was the American tobacco farmers, because they're able to change the conversation. It's not, you know, about the health risk of smoking. It's, you know, old Zeke here in a pair of bib overalls and the salt of the earth farmer, and, you know, who's going to vote, you know, to take away his livelihood. So they had this huge sort of built-in army of goodwill public relations advocate. But at the same time, they were aggressively screwing these guys because they realized that they could grow tobacco for about 90% cheaper in Malawi and Brazil and, you know, various places in South America. So we were taking a look at that, and the third piece of it was how they were basically hedging against the total collapse of the American tobacco market that they envisioned in the future, and that was to push into the largely restricted third world market and the Asian market. And they were doing that not just through aggressive marketing and advertising that was prohibited in this country, but they were doing it with the help of the United States Trade Representative's office that was pressuring foreign governments with enormous trade sanctions if they didn't open their markets. So all in all, what we thought was a pretty solid hour, and ABC agreed. And they gave us, I mean, the budget of this thing was about $500,000 in 1993. And as I watched it for the first time in a while yesterday. And we shot in Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Seattle, Louisville, Kentucky, San Jose, San Francisco, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, Taipei, Bangkok, and Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil. And we waged a costly FOIA battle with the United States Trade Rep Office that was also funded by ABC and their law firm, William Cutler Pickering. So they were very much on our side and very supportive. We went through a number of screenings with the executives. They were all very enthusiastic about it. And in the end, we actually finished the hour. In fact, we had our wrap party for it at Marty's apartment. It was February 28th, 1994. We interrupted our wrap party because some of the people that were at the party had been interviewed for Walt's Day One piece that was airing that night. So we stopped our party and we gathered and we watched Walt's piece on Day One. And we thought, man, boy, now ours is coming up next. This is going to be great. We got them fun. And that was it. And then 3 weeks later, Walt got sued. And then I guess this is where I'm supposed to stop the story, right? but ABC was totally, they had our back the whole way, up till the point where the Philip Morris lawyers rolled in, thanks to Walt. Well, you take it from there.
I just want to make two factoids that clarify, that add to what you just said contextually. The first one is that in the 20th century, 100 million people died from smoking-related illnesses in the world. In the 21st century, it is expected to be 1 billion people, according to the World Health Organization, both statistics. The other thing is, from 1979 to today, every president's U.S. trade representative, which is a cabinet office position, part of the executive office of the White House, every single one has helped the tobacco industry export tobacco around the world, and they've been steadily doing it now for 30-plus years. So that's not unrelated to those earlier statistics I just mentioned to you. So anyway, with that, we go to one Martin Kuhn.
I just want to add one thing. Woo, here we go. I just want to add one thing that they were using the U.S. trade rep not just to get into the market, but to break the local Asian tobacco monopolies and permit them to advertise, because in all those Asian markets where there was a monopoly, there was a prohibition against advertising. So our U.S. Trade Representative's office hooked up with Philip Morris and went country by country, Japan, Taiwan, Thailand, Indonesia, and in each case got them to roll over and allow us to market. And that's when smoking rates among Asian women and children went right through the roof. Important context here. What Walt did with his piece was he took a metal probe and he put it right on the rawest nerve of the tobacco industry. Because what his piece was all about was that, simple as it sounds, but it was astonishing at the time, that in the process of making the tobacco, the cigarettes you buy today, at some point in that process, they take all the nicotine out of the cigarette. And then they put it back in. Their explanation, flavor. Right? Well, okay. But at the very same time that Walt did that piece, and at the time, understand, no federal health agency had any regulatory oversight over tobacco. Tobacco was specifically exempted from every law, the Consumer Product Safeties Act, the Clean Air Act, all these things, specifically exempted. So nobody in the federal government health administration had any control over tobacco. And David Kessler, who was the FDA commissioner at the time, decided that had to change. And so we had, at the very time that Walt was doing his piece, a team of dozens of investigators under the great Jack Mitchell pushing to, you know, make the case for regulating tobacco because nicotine was an addictive drug. Well, as it turns out, 2 years later, they got exactly that. Again, it was just a month after the lawsuit, remember, that the tobacco chiefs were holding their hand up and saying nicotine is not addictive. Well, 2 years later, the FDA established, yes, it was. It got regulatory control, and that decision was the straw that broke Joe Camel's back. Marketing went out the window. All kinds of restrictions came down, secondhand smoke restrictions. And 2 years after that, Big Tobacco confessed to all their crimes, rolled over on the class action lawsuit, and agreed to pay $385 billion for all the things they said they hadn't been doing all those years. So, in other words, Walt had put ABC News out on in front of the biggest public health story of the decade. No, the century, when you look at the mortality rates. And what did ABC News do? I mean, this was always the also-ran network at the time. Did they mount a big publicity campaign saying, good for us, look at us, we're major leaguers? No. They apologized. That's not right. They groveled. It wasn't really an apology. They read an apology that apologized for things that Walt did not do, I mean, provably did not do, in front of the next episode of Day One, on their front page, World News Tonight, Diane Sawyer read the apology. In front of their most highly rated program, Monday Night Football, they read that apology. And then the next day after the apology, Philip Morris took out an ad, full-page ad, in 700 U.S. dailies that said, apology accepted. Humiliating? Not even half as much as the next thing. Part of the settlement was ABC News agreed to pay Philip Morris almost $20 million for legal fees. In other words, ABC agreed to pay Philip Morris for the club that Philip Morris beat them with. So, you know, that kind of created a problem with our hour at that point. And, you know, having been approved for air, I mean, when the phone rang that afternoon of the lawsuit and Betsy West was on the phone, my senior producer, I was expecting her to tell me our air date. And she said, we've got to do some revisions here. We'll get back to you. Well, anyway, what they got back to me with was all the reasons why our hour shouldn't air. Because it had been announced to the critical press. So there were a lot of questions coming to ABC. Well, what about this hour documentary? Well, the only answer to that question was, well, it wasn't up to ABC News standards. It was boring. It was you know, nothing new, and, you know, that was the only explanation for why it didn't go on the air. And so my good friend Chuck here, in doing his book, by the way, 935 Lies is the name of it, and if you want to know what that's about, 935 lies are the number of lies told by senior administration officials to con us into going and attacking Iraq. And so in the spirit of lies, what happened here, he went and tried to trace down every single ABC News executive who was in any way in the chain of command at this time. And it's kind of an embarrassing read because they scatter like cockroaches. They don't answer their emails. They won't answer their phone. When they do, they're very evasive. Chuck did find one honest man in the crowd, Dick Wald, who was the executive in charge of editorial quality at ABC at the time, finally told Chuck, at a point before the Turning Point Tobacco program was to go on the air, the corporate guys called Rune Arledge, the president of the division, to say they wanted to kill it, and he acquiesced. I think his words at the time were, they own the football, and it was ultimately their call. Ah, the truth. 20 years later, but it's the truth. It's not like any of us didn't know what that was 20 years ago. It's just nobody on their end was admitting that. Yeah, so they couldn't tell the truth for corporate reasons, so they lied. All right. But it's who carried the lie that was really interesting. Was it the corporate execs who were going to make millions of dollars when the merger with Disney went through? No. As a matter of fact, Tom Murphy still wouldn't speak to you 20 years later. Was it the law department who was basically running this show? Are you kidding me? So who carried the lie? It was the news executives. Of course. So the senior vice president over our show, a guy named Paul Friedman, he went on a tear for months. The program was never approved for air, he said. It wasn't up to our standards. Provable lie. Now, you folks have the first opportunity in 20 years to see this program. We have just put it up on the Internet Archive, and if you search for Tobacco Under Fire, you can watch the program that no one has seen in 20 years, and you make your own judgments. But what you will notice in that show is that the color is corrected, the sound has been mixed, and all the graphics are integrated. Now, for a documentary, that's at minimum 10% of the budget, which means ABC News put down over 50 grand to put it in that condition. They didn't do that, even in 1994. They didn't spend that kind of money unless they planned to air this thing. But that's not what Paul Friedman was holding forth. His other thing, his other argument when pressed on why this thing wasn't there, was a boring rehash. Well, all right, the boring part, it was Paul Friedman. He might have been bored. The rehash part, provable lie. 2 years later, 60 Minutes, and Scott Bronstein is sitting right here, he's responsible for that, and Mike Wallace did the third story told you about the Philip Morris's marketing to Asia. 2 years later, Mike was not one for rehashes. Another thing Paul Friedman kept saying was, the lawsuit never entered my mind when I was doing this, killing that story. If that's true, you're not lying, you're a moron. My direct superior in this case, Betsy West, the one who signed off on it, the one who told us great stuff in our last screening, and wow, waiting for air, she said, well, Q&A absolutely refused to make it better, absolutely refused to sit down and, work with us on this project. A spectacular lie. That afternoon when we got the call that we thought it was our air date, I said, well, okay, quickly, I got the drift of where we were going here. I said, well, let's get together. So we set up a meeting. A week later, I took a train up from Washington, went to the appointed meeting room at ABC News headquarters and sat there for an hour, and no one else ever came. And no other meeting was ever scheduled. And I only received one other call from ABC after that. And it was from a fellow from the law department. This was about 2 weeks later, instructing me to take all of my notes, all of my memos, all of my scripts, all of my FOIA documents, seal them up in nice boxes and send them to him. At which point I got the distinct impression we weren't talking revision anymore here. So I suggested that he do something anatomically impossible to himself. And he then issued to me the hollowest threat I have ever heard in my entire life. You'll never work for ABC News again! Oh no. We were doing so well. And again, Betsy kept insisting that the lawsuit had nothing to do with why this thing was not on the air. Well, now, if there's a mistake that I made, and this was spectacular, and if there's a lesson to be drawn, this might be it. when your superiors in public attack your competence and your integrity, do not respond in kind. That's what I did. And the moment I did that, I changed the conversation. Instead of being about a story about Philip Morris's nefarious plans for killing Asians, it was Mad Dog Producer Bites Master. And we went on for weeks of this horrid pissing match back and forth that completely ignored the sum and substance of what we were doing. And the mainstream press, they just covered the circus. So, you know, the end result of that was, as Walt mentioned, in August of 95, Disney merges with ABC. 3 weeks later, they do the apology. And a few days after that apology, a few days after that big, you know, epic, humiliating moment, the most powerful man in television, in my opinion, Don Hewitt, the man who invented the CBS News money machine 60 Minutes, walked into Lowell Bergman's office and said, lay off the Wygand interview. 3 weeks later. And, you know, you've all seen the movie. You know how that turns out. So, and I also, yeah, we already talked about Larry Tisch's role in that. So, you know, what's the moral of this sort of deal? You know, that if you bite a big, powerful corporate interest like tobacco, they'll bite back really, really hard. Oh, shit, you're the IRE. You know that. You've felt that already. You know, is it then when the going gets tough, your news executives might get like kind of spongy in the background, a backbone? Yeah, you know that too. That's not a revelation. I mean, for me, the moral really is a question you should ask yourself. What happens when you move from reporter to news management? What happens to your commitment to truth and transparency? What happens when what you know to be true is at variance with what is the corporate line? What do you do? And let me give you a little example of how sticky that seat might be. Transport yourself back to September 1995. You're Betsy West. Only now you're the executive producer of Turning Point. And the phone rings. And on the other end is Jim Ledbetter of The Village Voice. Remember, the mainstream media just covered the circus. Jim was the only person who actually went out of his way to track down, find, and screen a piece of The Hour. Nobody else showed any interest in what was in it. And when he did, he had a few questions for Betsy. You know, he couldn't help but notice that there were at least two what he called network scoops in The Hour. And the one about the tobacco farmers and undermining them by the tobacco industry and the Asian invasion. And he pressed her on that. And he said, when I asked West about these parts of the story, she said, quote, I agree that those are two of the more interesting things, but they were in the back of the show. Close quote. Okay. And she then went on to claim that other ABC news programs and CNN or CNN had covered these same stories. But then Ledbetter did some work, and he came back to say, but neither she nor I could find any record of that. So, will she work on fixing the topics she's sitting on? Ledbetter asked her. Here's her response. Quote, absolutely not. We tried to do tobacco. We tried our best. But we threw up our hands. Not something you'd expect to come out of the mouth of a journalist. You know? And, you know, what does Paul Friedman do now? He teaches journalism at a school in Connecticut. What does Betsy West do now? She teaches journalism at the Columbia Journalism School. I bet you the throwing up the hand strategy isn't part of the curriculum anymore. You want a truth? I'll give you a truth. There is no statute of limitations on crimes against journalism. It might take 20 years, but the facts will come out, the truth will be known, and the stink will not go away. I mean, it's been 20 years, and I still smell the stench of this one. And I bet you do, too.
Well, it's hard to follow that, Marty. I wanted to just once again throw in some. This is elements that are in the book, but it is true. I did go to the executives. I worked at ABC for 6.5 years myself, and in fact, I saw the rough cut back before. And as an investigative producer myself, I was utterly blown away because no one had ever shown this or done this story, and I had always suspected it. And I was writing articles in places like The Nation about the U.S. Trade Representative's office in the exact same sequence of time. We had profiled the revolving door with every U.S. trade official for 20 years. I was the first Center for Public Integrity report, 200-plus pages. So I was watching all this like a little bit, to put it mildly, closely, even back then. But in this instance, all these executives, I didn't really know Friedman. He wasn't there when I was there in another century. But the others all were. And so I did go to about half a dozen ABC execs. One of the ones I went to is not named, actually, in the text. But he essentially backed up Dick Wald, who went to journalism school at Columbia with Rune Arledge, as like one of his closest colleagues at ABC from the day Arledge became the president of ABC in 77. Wald, who also teaches at Columbia, essentially, well, he flatly said what basically happened, but it was the first time in 20 years no one had ever admitted this, including Dick. If I look back at what Friedman told me, I talked to him a few times, once or twice on the phone, and we had some email traffic. He did say something that I think is contextually revealing. He said that when he got a call one day, Rune Arledge was not well. He wasn't in the office. There was some, you know, health issues going on, and so he was like functioning as like the acting president in some ways over the news division at one point. And so he actually is summoned by the CEO of ABC Inc. to his corporate office, which is different than the 7 West 66th Street Upper West Side office downtown. And he was called into his palatial suite and told to basically sit down and start writing. And the CEO, the top executive at ABC, dictated the statement that that was their capitulation. And he told him he could not talk and he could not make any changes whatsoever. And that within a few hours that was out and it was on the air and Diane Sawyer was told to read it. That is pretty good indication of what was going on inside the corporate part of ABC. But the other part that is quite interesting that is also in the book is on the exact same day as the lawsuit, $10 billion, basically at 10 o'clock in the morning, there's a news conference in New York, Philip Morris says this. At 2:30 in the afternoon, there's a meeting in Rune Arledge's office with about five news executives, including Alan Wurtzel and Friedman, and lawyers from ABC Inc. and lawyers from ABC News, two sets of lawyers. That is the same afternoon that Betsy West calls Marty and says, you know, we've got some problems we've got to do some additional things. Anyway, were all those related? It's pretty clear to me they were related. And at this point, So anyway, Friedman, of course, still denies it to this day. His denials are in the chapter. Betsy West, who I've known for 30 years, she also steadfastly sticks by the original line that they put out, that it wasn't up to their standards. And that show had some other real winners of programs. I list some of the, yeah, they had really high standards at that show, Turning Point. I'll spare you, but check out some of the stories. You read this. This was probably the best thing they could have ever done in their entire life. It was not, that wasn't up to their standards. It's a pretty unbelievable statement. So that's the story here. With one industry and the attempts of, well, basically it's two networks. So CBS does tell, the part we were telling was, the one that did air was about how many law firms the industry had, 97 firms, something like that, were suing everyone all over the place, and no plaintiff suit ever actually won. They were able to stave off every single civil suit in America. And that's a whole nother interesting subject, but I'll avoid it for now. But, you know, the saga continues. They continue to sell tobacco, and at this point it's not a new story anymore, and it still goes on. It's all legal, of course. So that's where we are. Has that ever happened with other industries? Of course. Is this one of the worst examples? Yes. If you read closely in this book, you'll go from George Seldes in 1938 up to Edward R. Murrow, who loses his TV show, not just over the tobacco. He was the first to broadcast tobacco on American television in 1955. It's one of the few See It Nows where he doesn't smoke on camera, and he later dies of lung cancer. And then the other thing that I should note is after the advertising ban brought against the tobacco industry in 1970, from 1970 into the into the 90s, the news media, print, basically newspapers, magazines, they accepted $12 billion in advertising after it went off the airwaves. They moved all their advertising over to the print media. And in that period, no one won a Pulitzer, Polk, or any other Distinguished Journalism Award for their aggressive tobacco coverage. George Seldes in 1938 with his in-your-face newsletter called In Fact, 500 issues, 175,000 subscribers, more subscriptions, more folks reading his thing at the time than The Nation or The New Republic or any of the magazines. 100 of his 500 issues were about tobacco, and he got mad because the only people covering tobacco in 1938, the first study showing it kills you was done in Europe, and Associated Press moved the story, and no papers picked it up in the country. And, of course, why did AP move it? Because they're a nonprofit. they don't have ads. The other crusader about the ills of smoking, Reader's Digest. They didn't at that time take advertising. They were subscription-based, and the owners actually thought this was maybe a problem, this thing called tobacco. All the rest of the media avoided it. So the saga that we are describing here is actually been going on for over 60 years. If get away from tobacco a minute, Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle in its 19th printing now since 1906, fictionalized. Why was it fictionalized? Because he went to 30 commercial publishers and they wouldn't touch the subject he was writing about, the working conditions and other problems at meatpacking plants in Chicago. And so he self-published because no publisher would touch it. So we have a problem here, and we've had a problem really for a century, but the one industry we focused on is tobacco, but we all probably have our own stories. So I'll stop there. Questions are most welcome, and sorry for the uplifting panel here, but would anyone, you can either share a story or you can ask a question or whatever you'd like. Thanks. Or you can leave. Oh, yes. Okay. Wow.
I have a Paul Friedman story.
Yeah.
We were ordered not to release any of the documents while this lawsuit was going on. We couldn't speak. There was a gag order. Meantime, Philip Morris is obtaining all kinds of our records and releasing them and spreading them around. And I didn't think that was fair. And, you know, being a reporter, I sometimes got a hold of some good information that we had obtained through discovery that I wasn't supposed to have. And I will confess now to the world for the first time, this is a big event right now, that I actually leaked some of that shit. And Paul Friedman would call me up every time there was a leak, and he would call me, and Walt, that was an interesting document that I, you know, Nation reported. I said, don't you think that was interesting? I said, I don't know. I don't know what was interesting. Do you think it's interesting, Paul? Well, I think it's real interesting. Well, then I guess I think it's interesting, too. I mean, I wouldn't answer the questions because I didn't want to lie, because I figured then they have grounds to fire me. So I would just, you know, as we should do as journalists, when our job is to ask questions, not answer them. And I managed to avoid answering them through a certain skill set I developed over the years.
Hey, while you're talking, why don't you mention the legal advice you got from a mysterious caller one day? You know what I'm talking about, Hirsch.
Oh, yeah, Hirsch. Yeah.
Okay, I can't remember this. Sorry, then we'll go to the question.
Yeah, I'd never met Cy Hirsch, and I'm home late one night, and I pick up the phone, and his first words are to me from Cy Hirsch, to my ears are, "You're a fucking asshole if you don't hire your own lawyer." And this is Cy Hirsch. I go, "Oh, nice to meet you, Mr. Hirsch. Thanks for the advice."
I did.
So, yeah, please identify yourself and fire away there.
Stuart Watson, investigative reporter, WCNC-TV, Charlotte. Does the work product belong to you? Is it your product when you need it to defend yourself? For instance, documentation, et cetera. Is there ever a question about that?
I kept everything. You know, they may have thought I turned everything over, but I sure as hell didn't. No, I kept everything. Even when they told, and this is another confession, even when they told me to throw away all the super secret documents, oh yeah, you know, actually, there was a copy. I wasn't going to turn them over.
Like, for instance, could they say, physically, that piece of paper, ABC News paid for that, you're absconding with a piece of paper which has a value, which is ours, or a tape, an audio recording is...
The answer is, in a lot of newsrooms, they can do that, and they do it. I mean, there is a case. Remember the scandal with Scooter Libby and all the media squirming and going before grand juries and everything? If you recall, there was a reporter named Matt Cooper working for Time magazine, and they subpoenaed his notes, and he didn't want to turn them over, and Time magazine took his notes against his own will, essentially. I mean, they said, "We own them," and they turned them over. And the executive in charge took so much heat, he wrote a memoir trying to explain what he had done and cast it in some sort of light that he thought would improve how it looked. But anyway, they do claim that they owned. Even when Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward donated their papers to the University of Texas, Ben Bradley said in 2000 in Washington at in the IRE conference down there, that Washington Post owned all their notebooks and all their papers. The company owned it, but they knew that Carl needed some dough, quote unquote. So they let them take $5 million, and the papers went to Texas. But what I'm getting at is most corporate owners do claim that they own the work product. In many cases, that doesn't mean that journalists don't make copies.
And is there a way around that by paying your own Kinko's bill or?
Yes, the short answer is yes. I mean, they always claim that they own it, but most journalists are protective, and I think most journalists make copies, and that's certainly the best way to go, I'd say. Sorry, I didn't mean that.
Matt Drange, I'm a reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting. I'm wondering if we can back up just a teeny bit and get to the point of essentially strategies that you guys have had, successful ones, at essentially getting your story through your bosses, through your editors, to the, I guess, the opportunity to get it spiked at a much higher level. You know, it's sort of, you know, when and how do you go to your boss with something that you feel is very important, and how do you successfully sell them on that?
Well, I started a news organization called the Center for Public Integrity, and I decided there was nobody was going to bother me because I was the chair of the board and the executive director, which is really bad, but... I did
Smart.
It for the first 10 years. That was my solution, but I'll let these guys take a crack.
You know, my policy is to, you know, to bring them into the loop early on and get them excited, and hopefully they'll do the right thing. And there have been a few exceptions. Certainly New York Times has been great and, you know, supportive and everything. Most news organizations I've worked at have been honorable and tried to do the right thing and want to publish. I mean, there have been instances like when, you know, I did a big piece on the Teamsters Union, and they delivered our newspaper in Cleveland. There were some bumps in the road there. But at any rate, that's, yeah.
Well, I mean, the other thing there is that sometimes there are hidden pitfalls that you're not even aware of when you start a story. And we worked on a story at 60 Minutes about, I won't get into all the details of the story, but it focused on a tritium processing plant in South Carolina and a class action lawsuit that was going on there. And it was utterly uncontroversial within CBS until we were just about done with it, and we sort of figured out that at the one of the periods of time in question at this tritium processing plant, this tritium processing plant was owned by CBS. Because CBS had merged with Westinghouse and then was a successor company, and it was all very, very complicated. And the way we figured that out is that the general counsel for the tritium processing plant, for the Westinghouse plant in South Carolina, was now our general counsel. And so suddenly, there was a great deal of interest in, you know, this piece about some class action suit at a tritium processing plant 10 years ago. And there was no way we could have foreseen that. And, you know, luckily we weathered the storm, but it's like you just sort of never know where the landmines are sometimes.
Thanks.
This is really just a point of clarification, not to defend or excuse anything ABC did, not on the day one thing, but on the documents that they wouldn't let Walt cover. Their argument wasn't ever, nobody has said this, so I think I'll say it. Their argument wasn't these are very devastating and damaging to us. It was that they were stolen, which they were. Walt didn't steal them, but they were definitely stolen. They were Brown and Williamson documents, not Philip Morris, but that was apparently what they were afraid of. I mean, I don't think they were just afraid that it would embarrass the tobacco companies, but that they might have some liability for using stolen material.
Yeah, I mean, that was never actually explained to me that way. What they said was that if we print this and we're sued and somehow these documents put the companies out of business, the tobacco companies out of business, they could, for what's that tortious interference? Yeah. You know, they were going to, and it was some bizarre, I mean, we had every right to print those. We didn't steal them. Everyone knew we hadn't stolen them.
But I'll just tell you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before 1994.
Probably.
We turned them down.
I believe that.
Papers were stolen. The Pentagon papers were stolen. I mean, we never accept documents that might have gotten to us in a peculiar way. I'm joking. We do. I know. I know what your point is. It's a fair point, Mark.
Maybe not familiar with all the industry, and just think
yeah,
that
that's fair.
The only reason
yeah, okay. Good point.
No, it is helpful. Thank you. Any other questions? All right, I guess we will go. Oh, sorry. One last question. Thank you.
Just along the line of the documents, maybe a more general question. When you do get documents from a source like that, you know, you're told to show up at a hotel room and you get them, how do you go about verifying their authenticity? What's your process, generally speaking, for something like that?
Well, there were names, and there were dates, and there were descriptions of the research, and there were ways to double-check on that. And we also showed them to people who were very familiar with the industry and scientists and whatnot. And so we were able to be totally confident as to their authenticity.
Oh, I just want to remind you of one thing. If you want to see the documentary that no one's seen, it's on the Internet Archive. Search Tobacco Under Fire, and you decide how boring and a rehash it is. And anyway, just to aggravate ABC.